intellectually agile in a lawyer-like way in making distinctions that broke down the Jeffersonian dichotomies into smaller components. He was a genius at what Jefferson later called twistifications, that is, intricate arguments that seemed to be headed in the proper Jeffersonian direction, but then somehow doubled back and landed decisively on the other side. Much like Hamilton's dexterity with account books and complex fiscal figures, Marshall's reasoning usually appeared to Jefferson like the diabolical maneuvers of an evil wizard. He was also extremely adroit at doing the greatest damage to one's cause by apparently attempting to defend it. In the weeks before the inauguration, for example, he had admitted to having insufferable objections to Jefferson's election and to believing that Jefferson's political prejudices made him totally unfit for the chief magistracy of a nation which cannot indulge these prejudices without sustaining deep and permanent injury. But despite these reservations, he wished it known that some Federalist critics of the president-elect were unfair. If the Jeffersonians were divided between speculative theorists and absolute terrorists, Jefferson himself did not strike him as a member of the latter category. At a more political but less personal level, the man waiting to administer the oath of office to Jefferson in the crowded Senate chamber was especially offensive because he stood as the ultimate embodiment of the Midnight Judges. That phrase did not originate with Jefferson, though he quickly adopted it as a way of referring to the judicial appointments that Adams had made, allegedly during his last hours in office. The phrase itself was somewhat misleading, since it conjured up an image of Adams spending his last night in the presidential mansion, furiously signing appointment letters beneath the midnight oil in a last-ditch spasm of political vindictiveness before catching the early morning stage out of town. In fact, Adams had made the vast majority of his judicial appointments, including that of Marshall as Chief Justice, several weeks earlier, soon after the passage of the Judiciary Act in February 1801. What was true, however, was that all of them, including Marshall's, had occurred after the results of the presidential election of 1800 were known. So in that sense, they constituted a partisan action designed to force Federalist judges on the incoming Republican president. Adams could claim, as he did, that he was simply doing what Washington had done during his last weeks in office, but that precedent was rather weak because Jefferson's election represented a fundamental repudiation of the incumbent Federalist administration, whereas Adams had represented a continuation. To make matters worse, Marshall's appointment had no term. It was a lifetime seat that could be vacated only if Marshall committed treasonable acts or was found guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. This made him a kind of unmovable Trojan horse placed squarely in the middle of the Jefferson presidency, the official commander of a Federalist judiciary apparently impervious to executive influence or popular opinion. Nor was Marshall unaware of his truly singular position and his nearly open-ended opportunity. He saw it as a duty to make trouble. On Inauguration Day, just before he walked over to the Capitol, he wrote a reassuring letter to a Federalist colleague. "Of the importance of the judiciary at all times, but more especially the present, I am fully impressed," he explained, "and I shall endeavor, in the new office to which I am called, not to disappoint my friends." Jefferson, of course, did not know about this letter, but he knew enough to suspect perpetual mischief from Marshall's protected corner. The preceding day, anticipating that Marshall might show up late for the ceremony as a way of spoiling the serenity of the proceedings, Jefferson sent him a terse note reminding him to be present at 12 o'clock sharp. Marshall wrote back to reassure the president-elect that he was always punctual. Whatever mutual dislike and distrust the awkward trio of Burr, Marshall, and Jefferson harbored toward one another, it could be dismissed as a merely private or personal drama. At the larger public level, the tension present in the Senate chamber derived from two overlapping apprehensions. First, the ascendancy of Jefferson and the Republicans to power was unprecedented in the sense that the Federalists had controlled the federal government since its inception in 1789. Second, Jefferson's dominant political message throughout the 1790s had been almost entirely negative, in the sense that he had led the opposition to Federalist versions of federal power and objected to the creation of an energetic national government on the ground that it violated the original intentions of the American Revolution. Taken together, these two conditions raised serious questions about the very survival of a federal government the incoming president had threatened to dismantle. The answer to the first set of questions seemed clear and reassuring, and was essentially inherent in the very inaugural ceremony itself. Margaret Bayard Smith, the wife of the editor of the pro-Jefferson National Intelligencer and a member of the audience, put it most succinctly. "The changes of administration, which in every government and in every age have most generally been epochs of confusion, villainy, and bloodshed, in this happy country take place without any species of distraction or disorder." More elemental than the ostentatious simplicity and Republican symbolism of the inaugural parade was the fundamental fact that it had occurred at all. The peaceful transfer of political power from one regime to another, a problem that had haunted European governments of all sizes, shapes, and forms from time immemorial, and indeed continues to bedevil some of the most powerful nations of the modern world, had happened in a remarkably matter-of-fact fashion. The defeated Federalists were bitter, to be sure, but they had deferred to the will of the electorate. During the protracted debate and balloting in the House of Representatives in February, Thomas McKean, the Republican governor of Pennsylvania, had threatened to call out 20,000 militia if the Federalists tried to cheat Jefferson of his victory. Another Pennsylvanian, Hugh Henry Brackenridge, had advised Jefferson to seize power and convene the government without waiting for the House of Representatives to resolve the impasse with Burr. Several Virginians had recommended calling for a new constitutional convention to restructure the federal government in anticipation of Federalist skullduggery. But all such alarmists had gone unheeded, and their sense of foreboding had proved exaggerated. Although it was not what Jefferson meant by the phrase, "the Revolution of 1800, the most revolutionary feature of his elevation to the presidency was its routine character. To put it differently, the most significant events were those that did not happen. The answer to the second set of questions about Jefferson's political agenda as president was much more problematic. No one knew for sure what he meant by pure republicanism, except perhaps that it entailed reducing the size and scope of the federal government. "Mr. Jefferson is well calculated to pull down any political edifice," wrote one Virginia Federalist, "and those will not be disappointed who have feared he would employ himself in taking to pieces the national building." He warned that even the foundation will be raised in less than 4 years. The reference to the foundation hinted at the chief Federalist fear, which was that Jefferson intended to disavow the constitutional settlement of 1788. He had, after all, been elected as the leader of a political party whose central premise had been hostility to any exercise of power by the federal government in domestic affairs. What Jefferson referred to admiringly as the ancient Whig principles were entirely oppositional in character, having developed in England as the dissenting tradition against the accumulated power of king and court, then in America as the ideological basis for opposition to both royal and parliamentary power over the colonies. Clearly, Jefferson and his Republican supporters regarded the Federalist policies of the 1790s, especially the Hamilton fiscal program, as a betrayal of pure republicanism. But given the inherently oppositional logic of Jeffersonian thought, it was not just plausible, it seemed almost obligatory, that he also reject as excessive the powers vested in the national government under the Constitution. This meant turning the clock back past the 1790s and into the 1780s, where the powers of the national government under the Articles of Confederation were extremely weak. Indeed, considering Jefferson's deep-seated aversion to political coercion of any sort and his long-standing commitment to a dissenting tradition that regarded all government power as inherently arbitrary and corruptive in character, It was difficult to know where he drew the line that separated the legitimate exercise of political authority from the oppressive and abusive infringement of personal freedom. How could he take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, the Federalists asked, if his primary goal as president was to dismantle the federal institutions created by that very document? The answer he seemed to leak out to his Republican supporters in the months preceding the inauguration was that his intention was not to dismantle the federal government, but to shrink it. The true theory of our Constitution, he told Gideon Granger, is that the states are independent as to everything within themselves and united as to everything respecting foreign nations. This sounded very much like the position he had taken in the 1780s when the Constitution was being drafted and before Madison had persuaded him to support its ratification. It was also consistent with his view in 1798 when he and Madison had worked together to draft the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions in order to block implementation of the Alien and Sedition Acts, the one significant act of his vice presidency. There, Jefferson had gone considerably further than Madison in recognizing the right of a state to nullify a federal law within its own borders, even describing federal intrusion in state matters as interference by a foreign government. In October 1801, he had also let it be known that he supported a proposal being circulated in Virginia by John Taylor and Edmund Pendleton that called for a one-term presidency with reduced executive power, shorter terms for senators, federal judges removable by a vote of Congress, and constitutional limits on the borrowing power of the federal government. Whether one characterized these hints as shrinking or dismantling, they lent credibility to the Federalist rumors that Jefferson meant to destroy the current foundation of the central government and thereby allow the United States to become, like Europe, a series of separate nation-states in the manner of France, Italy, and Austria. If there was a consensus within both Republican and Federalist circles that Jefferson's election meant a radical reduction in the powers of the federal government, the only question being how much, and the only political disagreement being that the Republicans were overjoyed and the Federalists were terrified, the one dissenting voice belonged to none other than Alexander Hamilton. Acknowledging that it is too late for me to become his apologist, and that he did not really have any disposition to do it anyway, Hamilton went on to offer a backhanded defense of Jefferson's political principles. I admit that his politics are tinctured with fanaticism, that he is too much in earnest in his democracy, that he has been a mischievous enemy to the principal measures of the past administration, that he is crafty and persevering in his objects, that he is not scrupulous about the means of success, nor very mindful of truth, and that he is a contemptible hypocrite. But despite all these personal weaknesses, indeed in part because of them, Hamilton predicted that Jefferson is as likely as any man I know to temporize, and the probable result of such a temper is the preservation of systems, though originally opposed, which, being once established, could not be overturned without danger to the person who did it. Like everyone else, Hamilton conceded he was only guessing, but he did not believe that Jefferson had the disposition to sustain the kind of pressure required to dismantle the federal government. To my mind, Hamilton concluded, a true estimate of Mr. Jay's character warrants the expectation of a temporizing rather than a violent system. These, then, were the personal or private vibrations, as well as the larger political speculations present in the Senate chamber when Jefferson turned to the audience and began to read his inaugural address. One feature of the legendary account is absolutely correct. His voice was so soft and inaudible that few listeners beyond the first row could hear what he said. But he had worked on his address with the same diligence he had once given to the Declaration of Independence. And this time the words were all his, unedited by intrusive committees or meddling delegates. What's more, he had finished making his revisions in time to have the final draft available for the printers and the National Intelligencer on the day of its delivery, so it is possible that some members of the audience had advance copies that allowed them to follow his speech despite the poor projection of his voice. What they heard, or perhaps read, turned out to be one of the two or three most significant inaugural addresses in American history, and apart from the hallowed declaration, the most artful and eloquent public document that Jefferson ever crafted. First Inaugural. Like any seminal statement in American history, though unlike the vast majority of inaugural addresses by other American presidents, Jefferson's speech of March 4, 1801 can be read with profit on several levels. At the highest and most rarefied level, a place where Jefferson's stylistic skills felt most comfortable and functioned with near poetic felicity, his speech contained several passages that echo across the ages with memorable phrasings. As an eloquent statement of the becoming modesty joined with panoramic wisdom that we look for in a new president, for example, none has said it better. I have learned to expect that it will rarely fall to the lot of imperfect man to retire from this station with the reputation and the favor which bring him into it. I shall often go wrong through defect of judgment. When right, I shall often be thought wrong by those whose positions will not command a view of the whole ground. I ask for your indulgence for my own errors, which will never be intentional, and your support against the errors of others, who may condemn what they would not if seen in all its parts. Or if one were searching for a classic rendering of the principle of free speech, no American statesman had ever put it so succinctly. If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this Union or to change its Republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it. Or, to take a final illustration out of several equally eloquent entries, there is this concise formulation of America's domestic and foreign policy goals. Equal and exact justice to all men, of whatever state or persuasion, religious or political, peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. It was Jefferson, not Washington, who coined the term entangling alliances. But the most oft-quoted words, which can also reach across time as a lyrical expression of transcendent truth, are in fact fully comprehensible only when seen within the context of American politics in 1801. Apart from the natural rights section of the Declaration of Independence, this is probably the most famous political statement that Jefferson ever made. But every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. This was also the passage that virtually all the reporters and interested observers fastened upon at the time, because it seemed to represent Jefferson's clear, indeed grand, statement of conciliation and moderation. It signaled that the bitter party battles of the 1790s would not continue in the Jefferson presidency, that the incoming Republicans would not seek revenge for past Federalist atrocities, like the Alien and Sedition Acts, and, most significant, that Jefferson's understanding of pure republicanism did not mean a radical break with Federalist policies or a dramatic repudiation of the governmental framework established in the Constitution. Hamilton spoke for the relieved Federalists, who viewed the address as a candid retraction of past misapprehensions and a pledge to the community that the new president will not lend himself to dangerous innovations, but in essential points will tread in the steps of his predecessors. But Jefferson did not really mean what Hamilton and all the other commentators thought they heard him say. Part of the problem was actually a matter of translation. In the version of his address printed in the National Intelligencer and then released to the newspapers throughout the country, the key passage read, "We are all Republicans, we are all Federalists." By capitalizing the operative terms, the printed version had Jefferson making a gracious statement about the overlapping goals of the two political parties. But in the handwritten version of the speech that Jefferson delivered, the key words are not capitalized. Jefferson was therefore referring not to the common ground shared by the two parties, but to the common belief, shared by all American citizens, that a Republican form of government and a federal bond among the states were most preferable. Since one would have been hard-pressed to discover a handful of American citizens who disagreed with this observation, his statement was more a political platitude than an ideological concession. The impression that Jefferson had publicly retracted his previous statements about the party conflict as a moral struggle between the focus of light and the forces of darkness was, as it turned out, badly mistaken. There were several suggestive passages that provided clues to Jefferson's truly visionary version of pure republicanism, but most commentators were too transfixed by the apparent message of moderation to notice. John Marshall, who was presumably close enough to the podium to hear the speech as delivered, went straight back to his office and recorded his impression. "I have administered the oath to the president. It, the inaugural address, is in direct terms giving the lie to the violent party declamation which had elected him, but it is strongly characteristic of his political theory." Marshall was right, though he did not specify what he meant by political theory. But this was hardly the Chief Justice's fault. A crucial component of Jefferson's genius was his ability to project his vision of American politics at a level of generalization that defied specificity and in a language that seemed to occupy an altitude where one felt obliged to look up and admire without being absolutely certain about the details. One such passage in the inaugural address occurred when Jefferson was enumerating the natural advantages enjoyed by American citizens who were separated by nature and a wide ocean from the exterminating havoc of one quarter of the globe, and had the good fortune to possess a chosen country with room enough for our descendants to the 100th and 1,000th generation. Then he concluded the list of assets with what he called one thing more: a wise and frugal government, which shall restrain men from injuring one another, which shall leave them free to regulate their pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government, and this is necessary to close the circle of our felicities. This was Jefferson's clearest statement of his minimalist theory of government. While Federalists were listening nervously for clarifications of his position on executive authority, the role of the judiciary and the proper jurisdiction of federal versus state law, Jefferson framed his answer at a level where all such distinctions dissolved. The very notion of government itself was the core problem. In that sense, he remained true to his Whig tradition, which stigmatized all forms of political power as inherently corrupt, as well as to his own ideal of personal autonomy, which regarded any explicit exercise of authority that was not consensual or voluntary as inherently invasive. Though an old and venerable political tradition and a long-standing Jeffersonian conviction, this perspective assumed a novel shape in the inaugural address because it meant that Jefferson was declaring that his primary responsibility as president was to render ineffectual and invisible the very government he was elected to lead. On the face of it, this seemed to put him in a strange and anomalous position, much like naming Luther to head the Catholic Church. The obvious question that followed logically from this disavowal of a positive role for government was not lost on Jefferson himself. He raised it midway through his speech and made at least a glancing attempt at an answer. "I know, indeed, that some honest men fear that a Republican government cannot be strong, that this government is not strong enough. But would the honest patriot, in the full tide of successful experiment, abandon a government which has so far kept us free and firm on the theoretic and visionary fear that this government, the world's best hope, may possibly want energy to preserve itself? I trust not. I believe this, on the contrary, the strongest government on earth. I believe it is the only one where every man, at the call of the laws, would fly to the standard of the law and would meet invasions of the public order at his own personal concern." This is both the richest and the most elusive passage in Jefferson's inaugural address. It acknowledged, at least implicitly, that his election had prompted widespread apprehension about the dismemberment of the federal government and the resulting dissolution of the National Union. But then Jefferson inverted the argument, claiming that his critics had been seized by a theoretic and visionary fear. This, in fact, was precisely the accusation being leveled against him, namely that he was a naive visionary who lacked a realistic understanding of how much national stability depended upon an energetic federal government that he, not his Federalist critics, as he seemed to say, had pledged to dismantle. Jefferson had somehow transformed himself into the defender of a national government as the world's best hope, a phrase Abraham Lincoln was to pick up and improve upon as last best hope in his own first inaugural, and consigned his critics to the role of skeptics who lacked his Republican faith. But the truly creative transformation, again more implied than asserted, was Jefferson's suggestion that the true, indeed only, source of energy in a republic was not the government per se, but the voluntary popular opinion on which it rested. The traditional presumption, which was a bedrock conviction among all Federalists, was that an active federal government was necessary to embody authority and focus national policy. In the absence of such governmental leadership, it was assumed that the American Republic would spin off into a series of factions and interest groups, and eventually into separate regional units. Without a strong central government, in short, one could not have a coherent American nation. In Jefferson's formulation, however, which must have seemed counterintuitive to the Federalists, the release of national energy increased as the power of government decreased, whereas the Federalist way of thinking about government concerned itself with sustaining discipline, stability, and balance. The Jeffersonian mentality bypassed such traditional concerns and celebrated the ideal of liberation. Lurking in his language about what makes a Republican government strong was a belief in the inherent coherence of an American society that did not require the mechanisms of the state to maintain national stability. In the weeks following the delivery and distribution of his inaugural address, Jefferson made a point of writing to surviving signers of the Declaration of Independence, as well as other colleagues from the Continental Congress who had also been present at the creation, to share his celebratory sense that the version of pure republicanism he had professed in his speech was a recovery of what they all had intended back in 1776. Whatever new and ideological experimental ideas were lurking within the rhetorical recesses of the inaugural address, Jefferson was absolutely certain that his message represented a restoration of the vision shared by the original revolutionaries as the ancient and sacred truths on which American independence had been based. He explained to Benjamin Rush, the only revolutionary gadfly in Philadelphia, that "these sentiments have been long and radically mine." And Rush concurred that Jefferson's address gave poetic expression to the values they had all thought they were fighting for in the glory days. Something magical and spiritual had happened at the founding moment, a kind of primal encounter with political purity that all the original participants experienced as a collective epiphany. Jefferson's first instinct was to share with his fellow survivors and sharers of that experience, outsiders and the younger generation could not understand, that the true spirit of 76 was back. The sinners had at last been cast out of the temple, and the saints were once again in control. His emphasis on austerity and simplicity, both in the inaugural ceremony itself and in his prescriptions for a stripped-down federal government, represented his core conviction about the recovered meaning of what the American Revolution had been about, and what his own election to the presidency had reestablished. Much like his fondness for a little rebellion now and then, or for sweeping away the accumulated debris of history every generation, Jefferson regarded his ascendance to power as a mandate to purge the American government of all the excess institutional baggage it had acquired since its pristine birth a quarter century earlier. While his Federalist critics and even some of his moderate Republican supporters worried out loud how far Jeffersonian reform would go, did it include eliminating the National Bank, the federal judiciary, the Navy? Jefferson's own mind simply did not work at that level of specificity. His thinking about his presidential agenda, like his lyrical language in the inaugural address, hovered above such particulars. As he explained to John Dickinson, another of the revolutionary band of brothers, the American government was like a ship that had passed through some very rough seas. We shall put her back on her republican tack, and she will show, by the beauty of her motion, the skill of her builders. Once the nation was put on its proper course, in short, forces as natural as the wind and tide would take over and carry America toward its destiny. God was not in the details for Jefferson. He was in the sky and stars. If one could just align the ship of state with them again, all those minor squabbles about executive power or federal jurisdiction would become irrelevant and sink from sight. Those who kept raising nettlesome questions about such items were inadvertently confessing that they had lacked the pure Republican faith. The Textual Presidency. Wherever one might wish to locate God's abiding presence, its political manifestation was very much on Jefferson's side at the start of his presidency. As it turned out, Adams had been the perfect predecessor. His irascible and all-too-human executive style had contrasted unfavorably with the Olympian presence of the godlike Washington, thereby making Adams unpopular and lowering expectations for his own successor. What's more, the most unpopular and unilateral act of the Adams presidency, to send an American delegation to Paris with instructions to negotiate an end to the quasi-war with France, had proved to be a brilliant success. The terms of the new peace treaty arrived too late to help Adams in the presidential election of 1800, but in time to end the quasi-war before Jefferson took office. And not only was America at peace with the European powers, but France and England had agreed to what was in effect an armistice in their seemingly perpetual struggle of the domination of Europe. Jefferson inherited the most stable and peaceful international scene since the United States had declared its independence. On the home front, Providence proved just as kind. The much-despised Alien and Sedition Acts, which had allowed the Federalists to prosecute their most outspoken Republican opponents for treason, had in fact backfired, helping mobilize popular support for Republican candidates in the congressional elections of 1800. In the new Congress coming to Washington with Jefferson, the Republicans enjoyed a 2-to-1 majority in the House and a smaller but decided majority in the Senate. What's more, the legislation that had created the Alien and Sedition Acts was due to lapse in the early months of Jefferson's presidency, so he needed to do nothing on that score but wait. Add to this happy set of circumstances the resumption of a flourishing West Indian trade, now that peace with France was restored, an overall expansion of American commerce with a now peaceful Europe had an agrarian economy that was humming along at unprecedented levels of productivity, and Jefferson's vision of a minimalist federal government, pursuing what he described as a noiseless course, unattractive of notice, began to look like a sensible act of hands-off statesmanship. With history dealing out cards like this, who would not want to stand pat? As it turned out, even the most invisible and unobtrusive federal government required executive leadership, if for no other reason than to implement the principle of Republican austerity. Here again, Jefferson was the beneficiary of the Adams administration, but this time as a graphic example of how not to do it. My wish is to collect in a mass around the administration all the abilities and the respectability to which the offices exercised here can give employ, Jefferson explained, adding that he was determined to give none of them to secondary characters. Adams, not certain about how much discretion he possessed as incoming president, had felt obliged to retain Washington's cabinet as his own. It proved to be the most disastrous decision of his presidency and the chief source of his political frustrations, since he inherited the secondary characters Jefferson was referring to, as well as a cabinet more loyal to Hamilton and to memories of Washington than to Adams himself. Jefferson later recalled that Adams became so frustrated by the recalcitrance of his own cabinet that he ended up convening it in order to scream obscenities at its advice while stomping around the cabinet meeting room and dashing and trampling his wig on the floor. The cabinet choices Jefferson made were governed by two criteria: proven ability and complete loyalty to the Jeffersonian version of republicanism. On this score, he was extremely shrewd as well as blessed. His cabinet proved to be one of the ablest and the most stable collection of executive advisors in the history of the American presidency. The two most prominent and invaluable members were James Madison and Albert Gallatin. Madison had long been a foregone conclusion as Secretary of State. He was Jefferson's lifetime lieutenant and protege, a fellow member of the Virginia dynasty, a battle-tested veteran of the party wars of the 1790s, and the shrewdest student of the Jefferson psyche ever placed on earth. Gallatin was a Swiss-born emigre to America who had settled in Pennsylvania and quickly risen in the Republican ranks on the basis of his deft way with both words and numbers. He was short, balding, and hawk-nosed, but his unimpressive appearance and lingering Genevan accent belied intellectual powers second to none among the rising generation of Republican leaders. Gallatin was only 40, and he was the one man in America capable of going toe-to-toe with Hamilton in debate over fiscal policy and comfortably holding his own. Since Jefferson's considerable experience in foreign policy meant that, no offense to Madison's extraordinary competence, he could and often would serve as his own Secretary of State, Gallatin, as Secretary of the Treasury, was the most invaluable and strategically positioned member of the cabinet. The other members, if not secondary characters, were lesser figures. Levi Lincoln, the Attorney General, was a respected lawyer from Massachusetts, along with Henry Dearborn, Secretary of War, who was from the Maine District of Massachusetts. Lincoln was that singular phenomenon, a New England Jeffersonian whose Republican credentials had proved themselves by surviving in the homeland of Federalism. "Both are men of 1776," observed Gallatin, "and decided Republicans." The same could be said of Gideon Granger, who, as Postmaster General, was not officially a member of the cabinet, but had important responsibilities, dispensing patronage. Granger was that rarest of species, a Republican from Connecticut, where rumor had it that a Yale degree was a prerequisite for success in politics or the pulpit, and a vow of eternal hostility to the infidel from Monticello was a mandatory part of the Yale commencement ceremony. The eventual choice as Secretary of the Navy, after much unsuccessful lobbying of other candidates, was Robert Smith, a prominent Baltimore lawyer. Jefferson joked that he shall have to advertise for a Secretary of Navy because of the widespread presumption, which proved correct, that the main mission of the job was to scuttle much of the infant American fleet in order to implement the Jeffersonian goal of Republican austerity. Most students of the Jefferson presidency explain his leadership style in terms of the positive lessons he had learned from Washington and the negative ones learned from Adams. It is true that Jefferson himself referred to these obvious and opposing models as his guides, with the Adams model, i.e., sulking patriarch, less personally appealing and politically effective than Washington's model, i.e., military commander-in-chief surrounded by staff officers. In one sense, Jefferson's organization of the executive branch represented an adaptation of the Washington scheme. All business had to go through the appropriate department heads first. On every working day, each department head sent Jefferson a written summary of all decisions or issues in his area. Jefferson responded in writing, if possible, on the same day, and also made himself available for individual conferences before his daily horseback ride at 1 o'clock. Unlike Washington, Jefferson preferred not to schedule regular meetings of the full cabinet, convening the entire group only when difficult decisions or a looming crisis required it. This arrangement made the president, as Jefferson put it, the hub of a wheel, with the business of the nation done at the rim, conveyed through the departmental spokes, but all supervised at the center. It was a system that maximized control while simultaneously creating necessary distance from details. Washington's example certainly loomed large for Jefferson, but it is more correct to understand his executive style as a projection of his own experience and personality. After all, the symbolic significance of Jefferson's inauguration was intended as a Republican repudiation of courtly pomp and monarchical affectations, which were all a piece of the Washington model. And the military framework that Washington carried over from his experience as commander of the Continental Army was too explicitly authoritarian to fit with Jefferson's temperament, which preferred a more indirect expression of authority and attempted to create a consensual context within which all decisions had at least the appearance of being voluntary. He had, in effect, been practicing this more indirect leadership style in different ways throughout his mature life. It was the diplomatic style of the elegantly elusive American in Paris. It was the political style of the invisible but effective party leader who honestly claimed to despise political parties. It was the paternalistic style of the plantation master who had designed Monticello so as to make slavery almost invisible. It was the domestic style of the benevolent patriarch surrounded by an extended family bonded together in seemingly perfect harmony by unalloyed affection. It was, finally, the Republican style of the president-elect, declaring that his chief duty was to render the federal government over which he was to assume control unobtrusive and politically impotent. The common ingredient in all these contexts was Jefferson's urge to cloak his exercise of power from others and from himself. His own characterization of cabinet meetings, for example, emphasized the harmonious atmosphere. It borrowed from the sentimental language he customarily used to describe family gatherings. "There never arose during the whole time," he recalled in 1811, "an instance of an unpleasant thought or word between the members. We sometimes met under differences of opinion, but scarcely ever failed to produce a unanimous result." The consensual character of Jefferson's cabinet meetings was real enough, in great part deriving from the fact that Jefferson had selected men who shared his views, but he also orchestrated events to prevent conflict. One reason he kept full meetings of the cabinet to a minimum was to avoid argumentative debates. "The method of separate consultations," he explained, "prevents disagreeable collisions." When a heated exchange occurred in one meeting, he asked Madison to maneuver behind the scenes and let his colleagues know that such unbecoming conduct would not be tolerated in the future. "Will you be so good as to endeavor, in an unsuspected way, to observe to the other gentlemen the advantages of sometimes resorting to separate consultation?" To Mr. Gallatin may be remarked the incipient indisposition which we noted in two of our brethren on a late consultation, and to the others may be suggested the other important considerations in its favor. Full-throated debate within the cabinet struck him as uncivil. He wanted his department heads to work out their disagreements in private, so as not to contaminate cabinet meetings with a contentious spirit. If the Democratic ethos welcomed a wide-open, deuces-wild brand of political jostling, Jefferson's version of Republican serenity was incompatible with it. He seemed to want the operation of the federal government to be noiseless, invisible, and completely collegial. Soon after he formed his cabinet, he instituted the practice of scheduling 3 dinner parties each week at the presidential mansion in order to bring together members of Congress and their wives with representatives of the executive branch and foreign diplomats stationed in Washington. Some of the most vivid physical descriptions of President Jefferson come from personal reminiscences of guests at these intimate 12 to 20 people social occasions. Edward Thornton, the British chargé, was struck by Jefferson's almost theatrical effort to inculcate upon the people his attachment to a Republican simplicity of manners and his unwillingness to admit the smallest distinction that may separate him from the mass of his fellow citizens. Margaret Bayard Smith read his spare and unassuming social style as a mark of true humility. Louisa Catherine Adams, wife of John Quincy, saw it as an aristocrat's clumsy effort to affect ordinariness. The most talked-about incident occurred in 1803 when the newly arrived British minister, Anthony Merry, raised a huge fuss about the awkward evening he and his wife spent at a presidential dinner. In his famous History, Henry Adams made the episode into a delectably malicious set piece in which the courtly expectations and insufferable affectations of Mrs. Mary run hilariously into the Jeffersonian pell-mell rules of etiquette, which struck her as a barbaric free-for-all for seating. But the contrasting descriptions of Jefferson's social demeanor were merely another measure of how richly enigmatic Jefferson's self-conscious Republican style appeared to observers with different political agenda. The truly significant fact about the dinners was their underlying purpose. They imposed a huge social obligation on Jefferson, especially during the months when Congress was in session. He continued them throughout his presidency because they enhanced the prospects for creating personal bonds and emotional attachments that might help override political disagreements. If people sat down to dinner together and were obliged to observe the customary civilities, they were less likely to be at one another's throats on the floor of Congress the next day. But the laudable intentions behind the presidential dinners were greatly diluted by the very motives that inspired them. Early on, Jefferson established the rule, which must have struck some congressmen as bizarre, that explicitly political conversations were prohibited at the table. And after attempting to mix Federalist and Republican guests for a short while, he abandoned the experiment in order to avoid the threat of volatile exchanges or politically edged jokes about his French wine. Thereafter, invitations were sent out strictly according to party affiliations. Even more than the cabinet meetings, the much-desired harmony of the dinner parties was highly orchestrated. The dinners served another purpose that needs noticing, especially because our modern-day assumptions about instant access to the images and sounds of our elected officials impedes a faithful recovery of the way it was back then. To put it simply, the dinners represented the primary occasion for seeing President Jefferson. This was the chief reason why so many of the visual descriptions of Jefferson that survive came from dinner guests. Apart from his daily horseback rides through the woods and on the bridle paths of semi-rural Washington, Jefferson made no public appearances whatsoever. This constituted a break with precedent, since both Washington and Adams had delivered periodic public addresses before crowds and had appeared before Congress at least once a year to deliver their annual messages. Jefferson discontinued the practice of presenting his annual message as a speech, claiming that a written version was more efficient. It also eliminated the spectacle of the presidential entourage parading up Capitol Hill in conspicuous imitation of European royalty, then placing the members of Congress in the position of subjects, passively listening to his proclamation. Jefferson believed that a Republican president should be inconspicuous. He wanted to institutionalize a self-consciously non-imperial presidency. As far as we know, the only two public speeches he delivered throughout his 8 years in office were his two inaugural addresses. The chief business of the executive branch under Jefferson was done almost entirely in writing. Indeed, if we wish to conjure up a historically correct picture of Jefferson as president, he would not be riding or walking toward Capitol Hill for his inauguration, but would be seated at his writing table about 10 hours a day. He usually rose before daybreak, around 5 o'clock, worked at his desk alone until 9, when cabinet officers and congressmen were permitted to visit. He went riding in the early afternoon, returning in time for dinner at 3:30. He was back at his desk between 6 and 7 o'clock and in bed by 10. As he explained to a friend, he was in the habit, from considerations of health, of never going out in the evening. Apart from the months of August and September, when the heat and humidity of Washington drove him back to his mountaintop at Monticello, he was desk-bound. In his first year as president, he received 1,881 letters, not including internal correspondence from his cabinet, and sent out 677 letters of his own. This reclusive regimen made him practically invisible to the public. He even seemed determined to obliterate any traces of his written record as president, insisting that all his public correspondence be filed under one of the other executive departments, so that I shall never add a single paper to those constituting the records of the president's office. It was all of a piece. A minimalist federal government required a minimalist presidency. Political power, to fit the Republican model, needed to be exercised unobtrusively, needed neither to feel nor look like power at all. Jefferson's notoriously inadequate oratorical skills were conveniently rendered irrelevant, or perhaps made into a virtuous liability. The real work of the job played right into that remarkable hand which could craft words more deftly than any public figure of his time, and into Jefferson's preference for a splendid isolation where improvisational skills were unnecessary, control over ideas was nearly total, and making public policy was essentially a textual problem. Indeed, one might most aptly describe Jefferson's self-consciously unimperial executive style as the textual presidency. The art of making decisions was synonymous with the art of drafting and revising texts. Policy debates within the cabinet took the form of editorial exchanges about word choice and syntax. When Jefferson prepared his first annual message to Congress, for example, all the department heads were asked to submit memoranda suggesting items for inclusion. He composed a draft based on their written advice and then submitted that draft for their comments. He asked Madison to pay special attention to language. "Will you give this enclosed a revisal, not only as to matter but diction? Where strictness of grammar does not weaken expression, it should be attended to in complaisance to the pursuits of New England. But where by small grammatical negligences the energy of an idea is condensed, or a word stands for a sentence, I hold grammatical rigor in contempt." Gallatin tended to make more editorial suggestions than any other cabinet member, often writing out revisions more than twice as lengthy as the original Jeffersonian draft, and infusing his remarks with a critical edge that would have been unacceptably argumentative in full cabinet meetings, but became palatable when offered in the privacy of written prose. "As to style," he wrote in 1802, "I am a bad judge, but I do not like, in the first paragraph, the idea of limiting the quantum of thankfulness due to the Supreme Being, and there is also, it seems, too much said of the Indians in the enumeration of our blessings in the next sentence." This extraordinary reliance on the written word had some ironic consequences. On the one hand, it allowed Jefferson to remain one of the most secluded and publicly invisible presidents in American history. On the other hand, it produced a paper trail that has made the decision-making process of his presidency more accessible and visible to historians than any other, that is, until the installation of electronic recordings under John Kennedy and the sensational revelations produced by the White House tapes of Richard Nixon. And because Jefferson's annual messages were polished documents designed to be read for content, and because his mastery of language was unmatched by any subsequent American president, save Lincoln, they present a remarkably cogent and peerlessly concise statement of what, in fact, and not just in theory, he thought pure republicanism meant. Debts, Federalists, Indians. Above all, it meant eliminating the national debt. During the nerve-wracking days when the electoral vote tie between Jefferson and Burr was thrown into the House of Representatives, several Federalists had tried to elicit a promise from Jefferson that he would honor the obligation to retire the federal debt, implying that the Jeffersonian version of republicanism was incompatible with fiscal responsibility. Little did they know how unnecessary such worries were. As Jefferson later explained to Gallatin, "I consider the fortunes of our republic as depending, in an imminent degree, on the extinguishment of the public debt," adding that failure to discharge the debt would send America careening down the English career of debt, corruption, and rottenness, closing with revolution. Redeeming the national debt for Jefferson was truly a matter of national redemption, a matter vital to the destinies of our government. He informed Gallatin that it was the highest priority of his presidency, and that it was unlikely that America would ever see another president and secretary of treasury making all other objects subordinate to this. He was not exaggerating. In 1801, the national debt stood at $112 million, most of which had accrued as a result of Hamilton's program to assume the state debts. Jefferson always regarded this decision as a political version of America's original sin, for which he was forever doing penance because of his own complicity. Following Jefferson's instructions, Gallatin came up with a plan to retire the debt within 16 years at the rate of $7 million a year. Since the annual income of the federal government, mostly from customs duties and the sale of public lands, was about $9 million, this left only slightly more than $2 million to fund the annual expenses of the entire government. But that was precisely what Jefferson proposed to do. In an ironic sense, both Jefferson and Hamilton regarded the national debt as the cornerstone of national policy. For Hamilton, it was a national blessing because it created the need for taxes, banks, and federal fiscal policies that amplified the powers of the national government. For Jefferson, it was a national curse. It conjured up all the demonic images associated with European monarchies, especially the layered levels of consolidated corruption represented by the political juggernaut that was the English government. It was also, however, a blessing in disguise, because it defined and disciplined the core mission of his administration. The central impulse of Whig ideology, as we have noted earlier, was oppositional. It required a clear and present danger to focus its energies. The debt gave Jefferson his essential enemy. Gallatin's program to retire the debt required reductions in the size of the number of federal employees, shrinking the army, and significant cuts in the navy. The debt, in this sense, was a godsend, because it became the budgetary tool for enforcing austerity and reducing the size of the government. It defined, in an eminently practical way, how a president used executive power to limit governmental power. It is difficult for us in present-day America to appreciate, for that matter to understand at all, Jefferson's obsession with a national debt that looks so comparatively small. The number of federal employees in Washington in 1801 totaled 130, and the national debt of $17 million is considerably less than the hourly interest payments that accrue on the current national debt of several trillion dollars. Moreover, the accumulated wisdom of economists and economic historians has taught us to realize that we ought not to think about the national debt in the same straightforward way we regard personal and family debt, as an unalloyed burden to be eliminated with as much deliberate speed as possible. Hindsight also suggests that even for those disposed to reject the Hamiltonian vision of an integrated and expansive commercial republic, the national debt Jefferson inherited should have been viewed as a wholly plausible investment in America's future development, a prudent loan, if you will, more than covered by the collateral of prospective economic growth. In all these present-minded ways, Jefferson's fixation on the national debt looks simplistic and silly. In a certain sense, it was, even in its own time. The single-minded passion he brought to the subject was extreme. Several of his more moderate Republican colleagues and a good many Federalists thought his debt-driven fiscal policy was excessively austere. Adams, sequestered in Quincy and licking his political wounds while preparing to settle scores in his autobiography, worried most about the dismantling of the Navy, which might one day prove short-sighted. The War of 1812 proved him right. But Jefferson's attitude toward the debt must be comprehended on its own Jeffersonian terms. This means recognizing the deep pools of ideological and psychological conviction from which it drew its non-negotiable character. Public debt was the unmistakable engine of government corruption, according to the ancient Whig principles. It set off all the tripwires and blew all the fuses of the Jeffersonian ideological circuitry, which then exploded in a flashing vision of Anglomen, monarchists, and scheming bankers conspiring among the ruins of the American Republic. This, it is true, was a conspiratorial mentality. It was misguided in its pathological association of debt with corruption and with its virulent version of Anglophobia, but it had been hallowed as a central article of the Republican faith during the American Revolution, and Jefferson embraced it with all the heartfelt intensity of a true believer. Psychologically, debt set off another kind of chain reaction inside Jefferson. Not only had he watched a disarming number of Virginia's planter class spend and borrow themselves into bankruptcy, but he knew personally what it felt like to remain one short step ahead of his creditors, even to experience the sickening sense that they would eventually hunt him down too. In his personal life, of course, we know that the looming specter of crushing debt had no discernible effect on his indulgent habits of consumption. The wine bill alone for his first term as president approached $10,000, and the expensive and apparently eternal renovations of Monticello continued apace throughout his presidency. Perhaps the soundest way to put it is that just as an extended exposure to slavery seemed to give Jefferson a particularly intense appreciation of individual freedom, so his private habits of indulgence gave him a peculiarly powerful appreciation of government austerity. In both cases, his public fervor grew directly out of his experience of private failure. In Jefferson's personal life as an indebted planter, the elaborate plans for financial recovery never quite worked. The numbers never added up. As president, however, the flow of history, as well as the managerial competence of Gallatin, was on his side. The exponential growth in American exports increased federal revenues even faster than Gallatin had predicted, allowing for an even more rapid retirement of the debt. The chief opposition to the austerity budget came from Federalists in the Senate, who warned that cuts in the military put American security at risk. But the Republican majority easily overrode the dissenting Federalists, and the extended European peace made Jefferson's gamble on a reduced navy look prescient. In his first annual message to Congress in December of 1801, Jefferson felt sufficiently confident to recommend the abolition of all internal taxes. He made the classic Republican analysis. Sound principles will not justify our taxing the industry of our fellow citizens to accumulate treasure for wars to happen we know not when, and which might not perhaps happen but from the temptations offered by that treasure. Armies and navies did not deter wars, they usually caused them. Meanwhile, the elimination of internal taxes further reduced the public visibility of the federal government in the most sensitive area of popular opinion, tax collection. By the end of his first term, Jefferson was able to ask the rhetorical question, what farmer, what mechanic, what laborer ever sees a tax gatherer of the United States? All the while, the budget constraints imposed by the commitment to debt reduction served as a purring engine steadily eating away at what Jefferson devoutly regarded as a bloated federal bureaucracy. We are hunting out and abolishing multitudes of useless offices, he reported enthusiastically to his son-in-law, striking off jobs, lopping them down silently. He apprised William Short, still based in Paris, that he and Madison were giving serious consideration to letting all foreign treaties lapse and closing down American embassies in Europe. This idea was eventually abandoned. Gallatin was able to persuade him that the National Bank and the customs collectors should be spared. They actually facilitated debt reduction. In modern parlance, they were cost-effective. Jefferson reluctantly agreed. It mortifies me to be strengthening principles which I deem radically vicious, he complained, but Gallatin was probably right that we can never completely get rid of his, Hamilton's, financial system. Nevertheless, the abiding commitment must be to simplify financial records, hack away at the entrenched layers of accountants, civil servants, and the core Republican agenda, bring things back to that simple and intelligible system on which they should have been organized at first. Leading the battle of the budget came to him naturally and drew from deep personal resources that all flowed together in the same direction. But the comparatively mundane task of distributing patronage bedeviled him from the start of his presidency. He wrote more letters and expressed more contradictory opinions on this subject than any other. His most colorful statement, that Federalist incumbents in government jobs prevented the creation of vacancies, that those by death are few, by resignation none,